All right, we won't bring it to formal order until we get a quorum, which will probably be very soon, but we can start out hearing bills. The House File 1838. Dwayne Self, are you here? There he is. And you can just introduce yourself, and we will wait to move your bill till we get a quorum. We got two more. Okay. Go ahead, Representative.
Good morning, Chair and members. My name is Dwayne Selk, and with me is Paul Cummings from the Department of Revenue. The bill before you is going to...
Sorry, we just got a quorum. Sorry about that. Well, then we'll bring it to order. Okay, we'll bring to order the Public Safety, Security, Policy, and Finance Committee and start out with a roll call.
Representative Cornish.
Here.
Representative Johnson.
Here.
Representative Hillstrom.
Here.
Representative Becker-Finn.
Here.
Representative Considine. Representative Dean.
Here.
Representative Frankie. Representative Grossel. Representative Howell.
Present.
Representative Lomer.
Here.
Representative Lucero. Representative Neuberger. Representative O'Neill.
I'm here.
Representative Pinto.
Here.
Representative Ward.
Here.
Representative Zerwas.
Here.
Okay, we have a quorum. Entertain a motion for approval of the March 9th minutes.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Representative O'Neill moves the minutes for March 9th. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, the chair will move House File 1838 to be re-referred to taxes. Now, Representative Self, go ahead. Sorry about the interruption.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So before you is a bill that's essentially a bunch of technical corrections that arose from a court case that arose and created some conflicts in terms of the interpretation of the amount of wait time and or what notice would be. So I'll turn it over to Mr. Cummins for his more detailed description, and hopefully we can have your support.
Good morning, sir. Go ahead with your name and begin.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is Paul Cummings, and I'm the Tax Policy Manager at the Minnesota Department of Revenue. I would like to thank Representative Salk for authoring this provision today. This provision was identified by the Department of Revenue staff as a needed clarification to the tax code. This was carried in the tax bill that was passed but not enacted at the end of last session. This proposal amends Minnesota Statutes 271.06 to make it clear that the same 60-day appeal period applies to everyone, regardless of the manner in which you are being appealed from, was transmitted, and that the date 60 days starts to run from the date on the order, not the date the document was mailed. The effective date would be for orders issued after December 17, 2017. Two court decisions in the last few years changed the longstanding statute of limitations for appealing a commissioner order to the tax court. The court decisions have complicated the determination of appeal periods for taxpayers because now the time period for administrative appeals to the department is 60 days and appeals to the tax court is 63 days, and those are in conflict. The proposed legislative change will restore uniformity and simplicity. Mr. Chair, we want taxpayers to make the decision to file an appeal with either their administrative appeals decision or the tax court based on the facts in their case and where they feel most comfortable appealing it to, not the length of the days in the appeals. So they can appeal to either administrative appeals with the department or to tax court, but they can't appeal to both. The Chamber and the of Commerce and the Business Partnership have weighed in on this language. They understand the lack of uniformity caused by these cases. They ask that language be included to state that the notice on the determination of action of the Commissioner of Revenue is sufficient if the notice is sent on or before the notice date designated by the Commissioner of Revenue, meaning we are not allowed to predate notices. We have agreed to that language. That new language has now been included, and the Chamber and Business Partnership do not have any objections to the language as updated. Thank you for hearing the bill, Chair Cornish and members. The next stop, I believe, is Tax Committee, and we look forward to continuing the conversation on this and other bills.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to make sure that Representative Salk got some credit for honoring the tradition of bringing in treats as a first-term member. And I appreciate him advancing the bill more importantly. Thank you.
Okay, member questions? Questions from the public? Representative Howe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. See, is there anything in the bill that when a taxpayer and the Department of Revenue can't come to terms on the what is owed and it ends up going to tax court, the taxpayer files for tax court, they end up in tax court, and prior to walking into tax court, somebody comes by, looks at the file and says, no, you don't need to be here, you can go home. And is there any time that they can get their filing fee back? Because I know a number of people that has occurred to, and they end up having to pay the filing fee, end up in tax court, and then before they actually get their day in court, somebody looks at it and says, yeah, you know, you're okay, you need to go. And then they're out their filing fee. Is there anything in here or any thought process of changing that piece?
Mr. Cummings?
Mr. Chair and Representative Howell, first of all, this bill would have no impact on filing fees or the situation that you described. I know that we can reach out to you, Mr. Chair, and I know the Chief Judge of the Tax Court is here today, Representative Anderson's bill. But, of course, we'd be more than willing to talk to you about this or any other issue in the Tax Court.
Okay, any other member questions? Any testimony from the public? If not, the chair will renew his motion for House File 1838 to be referred to taxes. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Thank you very much, Representative Stoughton, for your testimony and treats. Representative Rarick, House File 630. Chair will move House File 630 to be referred to the State Government Finance Committee. Mr. Rarick, go ahead and introduce yourself and begin with your bill.
Representative Jason Rarick. Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 630 is a bill that we carried last year. It was in the tax bill. Coming back again, we've been talking to all the groups interested. There have been a lot of discussions going on. I have a meeting set up tomorrow with all the interested parties to work out the final details. Right now, the language you have in front of you is the governor's language. The piece that deals with this committee, there is a piece saying that counties would get reimbursed by the state when delinquency and juvenile justice cases go forward through the correctional program. The DHS has expressed concern with that, and all parties agree. They have an amendment to take that piece out. And I believe everybody is going to agree with that, so that'll be coming out in taxes. We have a few other provisions that we're looking at. I believe tomorrow's meeting we'll be able to come to those agreements and have everything ready for property taxes. But this is a tax piece to help reimburse counties for out-of-home placement for tribal children.
Member questions? Representative Becker-Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When you say that all the interested parties, does that include tribal representatives?
Representative Rick.
Mr. Chair, yes. We're going to have DHS, revenue, counties, and tribal parties all there. So, yeah, we're going to be talking about it and come to that agreement. So.
Okay, thank you.
Any other member questions? Any questions from the public? If not, Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Rorick, I believe it was 2 years ago we passed a bill dealing with the Indian Child Welfare Act where the county social workers needed to work with them to get the things done because there's a lot of requirements in there that some of the social workers weren't aware of, and we got that taken care of. But this bill, as my understanding, deals with when the tribal courts place a child into foster care. This bill helps the funding because the counties are responsible for that payment. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, yes, right now Minnesota is one of only 10 states that requires counties to do the cover the costs of out-of-home placement, and of those 10, we're the second worst. This is a piece just to help start that process. There's definitely more work that needs to go along to help our counties out. Right now, this bill would cover all out-of-home placements for tribal children, whether it's through tribal court or through district court. That's one of the issues that we will be talking about, trying to understand if there's a perception there that would incentivize counties to place all Native children because they're not on the hook for the costs. But I believe a lot of people believe the provisions of the ICWA bill make sure that would not happen. Because the other way around, if we restrict it just to tribal courts, some people are worried then the counties will wash their hands and send all cases to tribal courts, and they may not be able to handle it. So that's the big piece that we're going to be discussing tomorrow.
Okay. Representative Dean and then Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Representative Ward. So as I'm thinking about this, and I'm thinking about the incentivizing of placing these children through these counties. I mean, can you explain to me really how this does that, and does it help direct Native children into Native families, and is there anything that's going to shift it so that might change at all because of the role that the county is going to have in the payments?
Representative Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Right now, that is one of the reasons why we're bringing this forward with just the tribal children, because one of the things that they try to do is to make sure they get placed in tribal homes, and then at times that can incur some extra costs. So it's one of the bigger pieces in the county budgets, and there's about 20 counties that are hit pretty hard by this. So that's why we've started with this piece. Part of what they're, like I said, the perception is there that if we reimburse cases that go through the district courts, that the counties would, say, well, hey, we don't have to worry about any of the expense, so they wouldn't care if they're trying to make sure that the child stays in their home. Because ultimately, that's the ultimate goal, is that the child would be able to stay in their home and not be placed outside of the home. But like I said, I believe a lot of people believe that the provisions of ICWA, the Indian Child Welfare Act, would make sure that the counties have to follow. They wouldn't be able to do that. They would have to follow certain guidelines in order to place the child out of the home, and then follow through with tracking that and paying attention. But that's, like I said, that's the big part of our discussion tomorrow, is to determine if we're going to limit it just to tribal court placements or if we're going to leave it through tribal and district courts.
Okay, Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can we be reminded of, I'd be reminded of where the bill's going next and sort of what the anticipated path is, I guess, maybe from Representative
State Bader. Government finance. This is the governor's language, you said? State government finance.
Okay. And then just a follow-up question, Mr. Chair.
And then taxes.
Okay. In a prior committee, I know there was some desire expressed from some colleagues that the bill would, because it's making a lot of changes it's going through, that it would go back to HHS finance or HHS reform to review the changes from that perspective. I guess, Representative Burke, do you anticipate that? Or just because the concern I have is it feels like it's changing so much along the way, just to make sure that folks with that expertise are reviewing things as the changes are made. Any comment on that or thoughts about maybe re-referring back to those committees or otherwise?
Representative Rarick.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pinto. We can definitely look at that. This is the funding comes through taxes, and Representative Allen, I've been working real close with her. We're going to try to make sure she can be at the meeting tomorrow as well. So I'll lean on her pretty heavily. If I know she serves on HHS, so if she feels it should go back there, I'll definitely look at that. But okay. Right now, my understanding is that we'd be ready just to go to taxes. So,
okay. So the final comment on this then is, Mr. Chair, is it seems like you're working really hard to bring stakeholders together from a lot of different perspectives, and so I suppose as long as that process goes through, then that does reassure me that maybe wouldn't be necessary. It sounds like that's what you're saying as well. So, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any other members' questions? Representative Bonin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And we must have just gotten this fiscal note, but maybe our fiscal staff could just talk about this a little bit. It says that it's a $5 million cost to HHS. Is that correct? Oh, excuse me. Thank you, $5,000.
What's that?
I was just saying that the fiscal note that we just got was an HHS cost, not taxes, but maybe the fiscal analyst could just talk to this just a minute.
Mr. Chair, the Department of Human Services put a cost on this of $5,000 in fiscal 18.
Okay. Any other questions? Representative Becker-Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just kind of want to reiterate what Representative Pinto asked about, because my notes show that in several of the other committees that the Native folks that did come and testify and speak to the real effect on the Native communities have been in opposition throughout. I understand you're making changes, and so I just wanted to reiterate that, you know, none of those folks are here today, and I think it's really important. I'm glad to hear that Representative Allen is involved in the discussion, and just want to make sure that's not overlooked. So thank you.
Okay. Any other members' questions? Any questions from the public? If not, the chair will renew the motion. House File 630 would be re-referred to State Government Finance. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay. Now we have Representative Tice and House File 1119. Welcome, Representative Tice. Go ahead and introduce yourself. And House File 1119, the chair will move that to be referred to the Job Growth and Energy Affordability Committee. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And members, it's good to be in front of this committee. This is the first time this year. But we actually passed this from Commerce in about 90 seconds, so we're hoping we can beat a record. What this does is actually put the unlicensed builder issue on the same page as some of the other industries that are out there. What we're finding is that right now an unlicensed builder is a misdemeanor, and we're upping it to a gross misdemeanor because cities don't enforce this because it isn't worth their time for a misdemeanor. With that, I'm just going to turn it over to Remy Stone to fill in the parts of it.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Remy Stone with the Builders Association of Minnesota. As Representative Tice indicated, unlicensed building activity is an issue that we've been addressing for several years. And we work with the Department of Labor and Industry and with our municipality friends to make sure that unlicensed activity does not occur within the state of Minnesota. Nevertheless, we find that it does, and we also, in researching this issue, discovered that our real estate peers, our appraisers, our realtors, our brokers, our insurance agents, everybody else, when they act in an unlicensed capacity, are gross misdemeanor penalties, and we continue to operate with a misdemeanor for unlicensed activity, which is equivalent to a slap on the wrist, if that. So we would support, or request your support of this bill.
Hey, Representative Tice, how does this change the, or either one of you, from the way it was? What's the specific thing that this bill does?
Certainly. So, and to so the committee is aware, the bill. Currently, state law treats unlicensed activity, unlicensed residential contracting, remodeling, and roofing as a misdemeanor. And the amendment that went on in Commerce, made it clear that it applies only to those three functions and not to every activity that is managed by the Department of Labor and Industry.
Okay. Member questions. Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill seems to be a win-win for everybody, the builders, the realtors. Every spring we hear tales of senior citizens being taken by these people as far as driveways and roofs and things, so I'm planning on supporting it. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions for members? Representative Bourdillon?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Tice, for bringing this forward as someone that used to be in the construction industry myself. Can you give us any other examples of any other folks that are licensed that if they, or say if someone was unlicensed and they were operating, that they would get a misdemeanor? Or I know you listed some that currently get the gross misdemeanor, but is there anything out there left that a licensure, you know, would, so someone that was practicing without a license would get a misdemeanor?
Certainly. Well, in our research, we know that hair braiders are a misdemeanor. We know that debt collectors are a misdemeanor. I believe that lawyers who act without license are misdemeanors.
Representative Bourdillon?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So anybody in the construction trades of any type or anything even slightly related, is there anybody that operates that would also get
within the trades?
Yeah.
So what we did is in our work with our peers in the construction industry, those who this applies only to those who need to be licensed residential contractors, remodelers, or roofers. Our electricians, our plumbers, the other carpenters in those trades, I believe that all of those will remain misdemeanors under 326B, which is the statute that that DLI covers all of us under. We did specifically change it to just apply to the residential folks to make it. We're talking about ourselves. We don't want to talk about them.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I appreciate you bringing this forward. And it's very telling to me that, you know, someone that braids hair without a license gets a misdemeanor, but someone that, I don't know, does your electrical in your house, practices that without a license, doesn't. So I appreciate you bringing this forward. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm supportive of this to fit this in with the other penalties, but I guess I want to go back to the comment at the beginning about city attorneys not pursuing misdemeanors, because and I feel like that's come up a couple times in the committee, and in my community, I feel like the city attorneys seems like do pursue pretty firmly. And again, this isn't restricted to this, just as long as that comment was made. Maybe this is just a general comment or something to be keeping an eye on, because I feel like I've heard this a couple times about needing to make something a gross misdemeanor for city attorneys to pursue it. And that hasn't been my direct experience, and I guess I just would ask maybe committee members or others to be keeping an eye on that. I'm not sure if there's something that we can do, because we shouldn't be setting policy based on that, right? We should be pursuing the crimes that are being committed. Again, this particular thing, we should penalize this the same comparable way, so I support increasing this to a gross misdemeanor. But I guess I'm a little bit concerned if there are truly prosecuting attorneys that are not going after misdemeanors. So I'm not sure if that invites any comment from the testifiers at all, Mr. Chair. But
Representative Pace?
Mr. Chair, I just want to make a comment, Representative Pinto, is that I think sometimes we're looking at it in a catastrophic event, whether it be a storm or tornado, whatever. I mean, I'm from Watkins, and they had the tornado last year. Now, a city of that size is so busy cleaning up and taking care of that and the influx of unlicensed folks going door to door. I was at my aunt's place and answered the door. It was a gentleman that had no contractor license on his card, had never heard of him before. You know, their issues are more about getting the city back to working again, and I think if they have to look at what the cost would be for them to go after for just a misdemeanor, probably isn't as likely to happen as if it was a gross misdemeanor. That would be something different, but I think for most of the part I look at, when we look at these catastrophic events and the influx of folks that come there, it really gets to be a little bit more, you know, do we really want to pursue if it's a misdemeanor? Maybe if it's gross misdemeanor, it has a little bit a bigger significance of a change that we can make to hold these folks accountable.
Mr. Chair, I guess I hadn't had catastrophic events in mind or kind of crises like you described, so that does make sense. I guess it's more, I feel like I've heard it in some other settings where it seems like they're, you know, the community's not facing that kind of catastrophe. From what you described, that certainly does make sense. In any case, maybe something for us to keep an eye on. Thank you.
Okay, Representative Dean and then Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Tice. I'm usually not a fan of increasing penalties and what we charge people with, but I think this is one of those areas that it is critical. My community was hit by a tornado, I think it was about 6 or 7 years ago now, and it was pretty devastating to see what was happening with contractors who weren't licensed or they were from out of state, they were storm chasers, and some of the things that they did in the way in which they preyed upon people, that they would get a down payment check and then they would never come back. For some of those, you know, they might have been out of the state by the time people were able to catch up to them. But I think that this goes a little bit in trying to make it so individuals would think twice. But my question would be, if, let's say I am someone who's a contractor, and I'm actually pretty good, but I'm not licensed, and I now would have a charge of a gross misdemeanor against me, would that prohibit me from getting a license in the future?
Mr. Chair?
Go ahead.
Representative Dean, no. In fact, all that it requires to be, our desire and the industry and the Department of Labor and Industries desire is to make sure that everybody is licensed, because when you are licensed, many consumer benefits go along with this. In our conversations with the Department of Labor and Industry and looking through the statute that already covers licensure, it would be required to be disclosed, but it does not bar you from maintaining that license, because our purpose is to make sure everyone is licensed. So just by having a gross misdemeanor, all it requires is disclosure, but it does not preclude licensure in the future.
Representative Dean.
So if it doesn't preclude it, does it create an obstacle of any kind? I mean, is the factor of having a gross misdemeanor on your background, does that cause problems? Let's say I had a gross misdemeanor for licensure. Let's say I might have had a DWI, didn't raise to a felony DWI. What are the type of factors then that would deny an individual to get a license?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dean, I don't do the licensing for the Department of Labor and Industry. What I can tell you in my conversations with the department, I don't see that Charlie Durenberger is here. The statute specifically requires notification, but it does not, it doesn't require any more of a bar than anyone else, as, looking at the statute itself. I'm sure they probably go deep into the archives to decide if there's larceny and other types of crimes. This is strictly part of the disclosure. Yeah.
Okay, Representative Considine.
I'll pass.
Any other members' questions? Questions from public? Okay, if not, Chair will renew his motion. House File 1119 be referred to Growth and Energy Affordability Committee. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Thank you, Representative Tice.
Thank you.
Representative Anderson, House File 1773. The Chair will move House File 1773 to be referred to Taxes. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What we are doing here is just changing the tax court appeals process on the time to file and also on the mailing portion of it. It is a, I hate to say this, but a simple bill. I do have Ms. Turner here. If there are any detailed questions, but this is at the request of the tax court. So that's it, Mr. Chair.
Questions from the members? Questions from the public? Any closing comments?
No, Mr. Chair. Just ask for your support.
Okay, the Chair will renew his motion. House File 1773 be referred to Taxes. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Thank you, Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
That's the fastest bill we've ever done. Representative Becker Finn, House File 1847, and you can move your own bill for civil law.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I would move that House File 1847 be referred to civil law.
Okay, Representative Becker Finn, go ahead with your testimony.
So House File 1847 is an agency bill coming from the Department of Public Safety regarding consistency and background checks. And currently there are inconsistencies in statutory language governing the dissemination of data. And so we're not changing the privacy. We're creating consistency in access to things that are already allowed in law. And then I will let my testifier explain things a little further.
Okay. Go ahead with your name and title and begin, ma'am.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Katie Engler. I'm with the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. As Representative Becker Finn indicated, this is a request for some consistency. The Bureau is currently working to program the criminal history system replacement that was funded in 2013, and we have found various provisions in statute that are we can't reconcile, and so we're asking for these two changes in order to provide some consistency. We've discovered in the more than 40 years since the provision in Chapter 364 was enacted that there are approximately 100 different background checks that have been authorized by the legislature with varying levels of data that are disseminated. And the result after the bill, which is before you, would be passed, is that there would be no changes to any of those provisions. We would still disseminate data in exactly the same way we would protect data as required by all of the other existing provisions in statute. And as Representative Becker Finn indicated, there's no change in any data classification in the bill. It's just a matter of providing consistency. And with that, I'll be happy to stand for any questions.
Okay. Any questions from the members? Any questions from the public?
Forgot to note, Mr. Chair, I did bring donuts from Dunkin' Donuts. This is my first bill. Roseville is home to one of the Dunkin' Donuts in Minnesota, so... enjoy.
Well played.
Thank you very much. You got a gold star for that. Yeah. And if there's no questions from members or public, the chair will renew his motion for House File 1847 to be referred to civil law. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you, Representative.
Thank you,
Jim. Oh.
Usually I pass, but not today.
Our last bill?
Not today.
House File 1670. You can make your own motion now.
For Mr. Chair.
Conclusion.
Mr. Chair, members, I think the motion is for it to be laid over for possible inclusion. And I think there's an A5 amendment, Mr. Chair. I'd move the A5 amendment.
Representative Zerwalk moves his bill, House File 1670, and also his offers amendment for the A5 amendment to get it the shape he would like.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Is this the amendment we discussed that missed the deadline, or is this an amendment that made the deadline?
Mr. Chair, members, this amendment made deadline was posted.
Yeah.
I just wanted to make sure this was the right one. Uh-huh.
Would I ever bend a rule? I don't think so. I'm a rule follower.
All right. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Hey, the bill is in shape you'd like. Go ahead, Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members. House File 1670 works at trying to help keep people compliant with the law and driving legally. It expands a pilot program that's been done in a few metropolitan areas over the last several years to a statewide program, and it also looks at making the statewide surcharge, the surcharge fee with tickets potentially waivable or reducible right now. If there's a financial hardship right now, judges have the opportunity to waive or reduce fine amounts, but not the surcharge. And so it's not uncommon for indigent individuals that work with the courts to get a speeding fee significantly reduced, but then have that $75 surcharge fee remain in full.
because it's unwaivable. Fines and fees for traffic and low-level criminal violations are intended to promote public safety and accountability, but in some cases they really end up doing the opposite. Individuals who lack liquid assets to pay a ticket in full and on time experience really an escalation of consequences, including late fees, collections fees, driver's license suspensions, which really can create a debt trap that may take years to escape, or quite frankly, they may just try to avoid and drive illegally as unlicensed drivers after revocation or suspension. A broad range of stakeholders, including city prosecutors, private defense attorneys, public defenders, racial equity organizations, faith-based organizations, civil rights groups, consumer advocates, and direct service agencies working with struggling communities, recognize the urgency of reforming our systems of fines, fees to lessen its disproportionate impact on low-income communities. House File 1670 makes the $75 state surcharge on all traffic and criminal violations waivable upon showing an indigency or an undue hardship. House File 1670 makes the driver diversion pilot program a statewide and permanent program. And then House File 1670 also streamlines the process for driver's license reinstatement. And that's a really important one. Currently what's happening between people going to court to address a suspended or revoked driver's license, getting that cleared up, there's a second step requiring people to go to DVS to complete that driver's license reinstatement. That second step is often missed. And so someone might be paid up completely with the court, think that they're now legal and compliant, and not finish that second step and actually be out of compliance and driving without a license being reinstated. This bill will help smooth that process and take that confusion out so people won't be unintentionally driving illegally without a valid Minnesota license. House File 1670 also establishes an early intervention for repeat driving after suspension, driving after revocation, or no proof of insurance offenders. And so what that is doing for folks that meet those categories, if they're involved in an accident or a collision that has property or personal injury as a result, on that ticket that will be issued to them for driving with a DAR, DAS, or no proof of insurance, there's what's called a crash box. Will be reinserted back on the uniform ticket that, once that crash box is checked, will set up a mandatory court appearance for that individual so that they have to appear before a judge since they were involved in a collision, and to make sure that they're aware of this program. This bill would also insert some language on the uniform traffic citation, allowing people to be informed if they may qualify for this program. To be very clear about a few things, the $75 surcharge is waivable at the discretion of the judge or the hearing officer. It's also would also make this reducible. And so oftentimes what we see in a speeding or another traffic citation, we would see a judge would reduce, maybe cut in half, the fee amount and not be able to do anything with that surcharge fee. This would make them have the ability to reduce it or get rid of it altogether with that offender. To be clear, the fiscal note takes the assumption that every Minnesotan that would qualify for a public defender would get their surcharge completely waived. We don't believe that's a realistic expectation of how this will play out. Perhaps reduced, but definitely not completely waived. And also, as a part of this, we have some information about fines and fees that have been recovered as a part of this program by bringing people into compliance with the law, getting them out of the shadows, and getting that valid driver's license up front and setting them up on a valid payment program. That's currently around $1.3 million with the expectation that if it was if this program was allowed to be statewide and on a permanent basis, that number bringing in could double. And so that's the bill, Mr. Chairman and members, and I'm prepared to answer questions.
Members, before we take questions, I'd like to have Mr. Walls walk us through the fiscal note, and that'll probably take care of some of the questions, and then we'll open up to member questions. Mr. Walls.
Mr. Chair and members, you have a fiscal note in front of you, and it is a somewhat long and wordy note, but the gist of it is at the bottom of page 9 under the expenditure and revenue formula. All of the fiscal impacts in this bill are due to the ability to waive the surcharge. The surcharge is divided among several recipients, and each of them, at least on the state side, would lose a portion of the revenue. The Game and Fish Fund would lose about $8,000 a year in revenue. The Post Board training account receives a percentage of the fee, and they would lose $321,000 a year, again, under the court's assumptions. And the general fund would lose $2.137 million a year. Mr. Chair, in 2018, the numbers are slightly lower than 19, 20, and 21, and that is due to a two-month cash flow issue. There's a lag in when the fees would be collected, so, or in this case, not collected under the assumptions of this bill. So all of the fiscal impact you see is a revenue loss that is assumed due to possible waiving of the $75 surcharge.
Thank you, Mr. Wilson. And that's one of the reasons we're holding it over. I like the bill, certain parts of it, and then certain parts are concerning. And so to work out those concerns, we're going to hold the bill over for conclusion. And Representative, any questions? Representative Hilston.
Mr. Chair, I will just say that we have some testifiers, too, whenever you're ready to hear testimony.
Mr. Chair, this is really about the fiscal note. Representative Zerwas made some assertions that he did not believe that every public defender client would get that fee waived. There are other places in the law where we permit the court to waive those fees. For example, the public defender surcharge that's currently in law, which is also, I believe, $75. If we could get some information about what actually is waived, we might be able to assess the accuracy of the fiscal note. I have a tendency to believe that in the event that it is waivable, the majority will waive. It will be more likely than not that it will be waived, and so we just need to make certain that that we fund it, because we would hate to lose programming in other places for lack of planning.
Any other member questions? Representative Considine.
Just real briefly, all traffic offenses, would this also include DWIs?
Representative Zerwell, sorry.
Mr. Chair and members, I think one of the testifiers can speak to the exact details on that. I know it's pretty narrowed down. I think only if in conjunction with Interlock.
And then follow up with Representative Dean after you.
I'll yield to Representative Dean with one comment. I'm not sure I'm supporting the DWI aspect.
Mr. Chair, I'll wait until after the testifiers.
Okay. Representative Zerwas, would it be Mary Ellen Heng, first one, Deputy City Attorney, Director of Criminal Division, City of Minneapolis?
Yes.
All right, go ahead and introduce yourself and begin, ma'am.
Thank you. My name is Mary Ellen Heng. I am the Criminal Deputy at the Minneapolis City Attorney's Office. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for having me. I would just like to answer your question since I can. The $75 surcharge applies to every single criminal case, from petty misdemeanor criminal tickets all the way up to a felony. When there is the potential for a fine to be imposed, that's $75. So there is a $75 surcharge for every DWI offender, misdemeanor through gross felony offenders, and it's a $12 surcharge for anybody that's charged with a parking fee. So that is just automatically added on top of any fines that are imposed by the court in every type of case.
Representative Considine.
My question was, though, would this bill then exempt them, or they could have it waived?
Yes. What this bill would do, Representative, would allow the judge the discretion to either waive the surcharge completely, as they have that discretion now with the client.
It's covered as all, yeah.
Yes, or they could impose a certain, a lower amount. They have that discretion right now with fines. It would just give them that same discretion when it comes to the surcharge.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other testimony? Go ahead.
I just wanted to talk briefly, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, about the DDP program. In my office, we are responsible for misdemeanor and gross misdemeanor prosecution, and about 10 to 15% of our caseload we spend on driving cases, and that might be a conservative estimate. And we are doing 25,000 cases a year, so it's a high number that we're spending on people that are simply driving around without valid licenses and insurance. That percentage does not even cover the numerous amount of people that are driving without valid license and insurance that my office never sees, because these are payable offenses, which means you can get a ticket and you can ignore it, and you are never forced into court unless somehow I, as a prosecutor, find out about it and file a criminal complaint against you, which then makes it a court-required offense. So there are thousands and thousands of more people out there driving without a valid license and insurance. And for my office, it really comes down to two prongs. Public safety prong, because we want people to be driving legally with valid insurance in the event that they should have an accident, whether the accident is caused due to some negligent driving behavior or just simply sometimes accidents happen. A morning like this, you hit an icy patch, you roll into somebody. We want those people to be licensed and insured so that our victims are taken care of. My office, we pride ourselves. We do a lot of different types of programming, diversion programs, and one key piece in evaluating those programs is there accountability for the defendant? We want programs to hold people accountable while also being fair to their circumstances, and I think the driving diversion program really fits all of that for my office, and that's why we've supported it. It started in 2008. It basically came out of the brainchild of then City Attorney John Choi, and his office was the lead prosecuting agency. My office jumped on board in 2010, so we've been on board for 6-plus years. The thing that I really like about this program as a prosecutor is it really does hold offenders accountable, but it also solves a big problem for them in that it allows them to get their driver's license back at a much earlier point in time, perhaps for some of them get their license back when they would never, ever get it back under any other circumstance, so they can continue to drive legally with insurance and continue to be accountable for all the violations they picked up because they continue to pay off all their fines and fees. And what happens is when they pay off a citation, under normal rules, when you pay a citation, you plead guilty, you may be subject to further suspension of your license. So it's this unending cycle of I'm trying to do the right thing, and next thing I know, I'm suspended again for 3 months or 6 months or a year. Under the driving diversion program, you continue to pay off the fines and fees, but they do not suspend your license. They leave it valid for you. So you can continue to drive, you can continue to work, and you can pay off all the fines and fees. As prosecutors, most of us that participate, we forgive some of those fines and fees because these people are making a good faith effort to try to do the right thing. And so that's a benefit to defendants. But I've seen people apply for this program that owe 30 to 40 citations totaling in, $10,000. And how the average working person who can't drive to get to their job is ever supposed to pay off that kind of debt, I don't have any idea beyond this program. So I think it really benefits prosecutors' offices because when they're licensed and they're insured, I don't see them. And I could spend my time prosecuting DWI offenders and other violent offenders that we need to be focusing on. It benefits the communities because they're out there, they're licensed, they're insured, and it benefits families because they're able to work and get better jobs because they're licensed. So without making this program permanent, it's going to sunset, and then we're going to be right back where we started 8 years ago, 10 years ago, where these people have nowhere to go. They don't have any hope of ever getting a driver's license. So we fully, fully support making this permanent and widening the eligibility so more people can participate. The last part of the bill I wanted to just touch on was the importance of the crash box. It may seem like a small thing, but again, it goes for me as a prosecutor in trying to hold offenders accountable when they victimize people. There used to be a crash box on a ticket, and it got taken off, I think, 2 or 3 years ago, because I think the view was the endangerment box would be sufficient. The problem is law enforcement doesn't always check that box automatically when there is an accident, whereas when we had that box before, it was kind of automatic. Oh, there's an accident. There's a crash box. I check that off. That makes that what otherwise would be a payable citation and not required to come to court, it makes that a court-required citation. And why that's so important is then they come to court. We then can contact the victim of that accident. We can follow the Victim Rights Act. We can seek restitution for our victims and hold these offenders accountable who are not only driving illegally but now have actually, you know, injured or damaged someone's property. We hope that you support that little change as well, because it really does go to public safety and to holding offenders accountable and helping out victims.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have a few questions possibly for the bill author or the testifier. So this is strictly related to individuals who are trying to get their license back. As far as if I wasn't able to get my license back because I didn't have a license, and because our state doesn't allow me to get a license, could a prosecutor or judge, could they still waive the fees for these individuals, or would those fees follow around the individual, and this would only apply to an individual who has the ability to actually get a license reinstated? Because we have people that are driving without licenses, not because they were suspended, but because our laws don't allow them to drive with a license.
Representative Dean, members of the committee, I'm not 100% sure on this, but I do not believe people who are not eligible to get a valid license can participate in this program, because the end goal is that you get your license back. So I think that there are some members of our society that are being excluded from this program because they would not be found eligible because they don't have valid privileges to start with. And so they may have a driving record in Minnesota because they're driving, they're picking up fines, they're in the system, but I don't believe they would qualify for this program at this time.
So, Mr. Chair, so just to clarify, someone who's undocumented and can't get a license, they're excluded from any of the provisions within this bill.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Zero.
Mr. Chair, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe this changing the surcharge to be waivable is separate outside of the DDP program.
Yes.
So the surcharge being waivable is for the entire criminal justice system. The DDP program and enrolling people in that and setting up a payment plan, that's all designed around getting somebody validly licensed, insured, and on the roads that qualify and it's eligible for a driver's license.
Okay. Another testifier? This is Jeanette Warner? Is that
yes. Good morning.
Okay, First Assistant Public Defender, Hennepin County Public Defender's Office. Go ahead and introduce yourself and begin.
Thank you. Jeanette Berner, I'm the First Assistant Public Defender in Hennepin County. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to testify here today. I think my testimony is going to be somewhat predictable based on the conversations that you heard earlier about our position regarding the surcharge. I would like to say that we are specifically asking for the ability to waive the surcharge when we have shown, the defendant has shown, of a true inability to pay. We're not asking for an across-the-board waiver. We're asking that it be treated like currently the system regarding fines. As you know, our role is to represent indigent clients who are charged with criminal offenses. These offenses range from traffic offenses, payables, misdemeanors, gross misdemeanors, and felonies. The clients that we represent come in a spectrum of poverty. We represent individuals who are just frankly destitute. They have no home, they have no food, and they have not a penny. And we also represent clients that are below the poverty line, where they are struggling to make ends meet. So all public defender clients aren't the same in terms of this particular issue. The current model that exists is just plainly not workable. We are not able to convince the court, because the court follows the law, that the individual can't pay and you should not impose the surcharge. We are able to make that persuasive argument with regard to the fines. I'd like to give you a couple of examples with how this has impacted, or at least one example in the interest of time, regarding our clients. I recently had a client who had a traffic violation. This particular client had had her license, got this traffic misdemeanor level violation, and came to court to answer the charges. She pleaded guilty to that offense. She took responsibility. She had conditions of sentencing, which she was abiding. The fine was waived because of her indigency. She was working a part-time job. She was caring for a teenage son, but the surcharge was not. The surcharge was $75. Where she was in her life, she was not able to pay that. She was just, it was the bottom of her list of financial obligations, and her license was suspended. The next time I saw her, she lost her job because she couldn't go to work because her license was suspended. The next time I saw her, she had made a couple court appearances on a review calendar. She was on the verge of being evicted. She still had her teenage son to care for, and again, she can't drive, and she had some opportunities for employment that were not easily accessible by public transportation. She was extremely distraught, and she opened up her purse, and she showed me a stack of napkins that she had secured from various restaurants that she had been to. And I asked her what they were, and she said, "This is my supply of toilet paper for a week." And, I mean, I say this to you so that you understand that this issue of poverty is real and that it isn't really getting any better. I've been practicing for 25 years, and I believe in the integrity of this justice system. I do. And I think that any judge, if you ask them, would tell you that it is a common tenet that an individual who is placed on probation or given conditions, that those conditions should be attainable. Because if they're not attainable, then the judicial orders start to lose any meaning. And I know that I'm joined by prosecutors. I can tell you that I'm joined by many members of the judiciary and probation officers who would support allowing judges to have this discretion. Asking defendants to meet the burden of proving an ability to pay shouldn't be assumed in every public defender case. It should be something that we have the burden of showing. And there's lots of financial information, as you might know, gathered on these clients through the financial affidavits of public defender eligibility. When barriers from poverty are removed, I believe the whole system benefits, because it is very tedious to impose these surcharges, certify them to the Department of Public Safety, certify them to the Department of Revenue, and they don't get collected. And I think that's really important for you all to understand. I've heard a lot about the loss of revenue, but I can promise you from my many years of practicing, they are not getting collected. Our clients are not able to pay them. I also would say that clients who can quickly get their license back by not having this barrier don't reoffend and don't come back into the system. And while I like job security, it is, I think, important to reduce the cost of prosecuting these low-level offenders. So for this reason, we're asking that you support this. Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am. The kind of puts us in a tough spot here, because it's a little bit, I like Representative Zerwas's bill and many of the provisions, but when you're talking about the fee, that's what we use to pay public defenders, and that's what we use to pay judges, and that's how we expand our drug courts and our grants for sex trafficking and victims' rights, and goes on down the line of a lot of indigent and people that need help too. So you see our balance here, where that's a lot of money. Representative Hillstrom, I think you mentioned a formula of, but go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I think last time I got a spreadsheet, it was for every $10 on the criminal traffic surcharge, statewide is $10 million. And so that's why I keep saying that if we're going to do this, we got to make sure we have the money to pay for it so it works. Mr. Chair, I actually have a question. Much of the testimony is about people getting their driver's license back, and when it's about the inability to pay, and it's related to these surcharges, why are we taking the license? why do we have that as a possibility? Because if we don't take it, there is no process you have to go back through to get it back. There's no, so that's Representative Zerwas, in this process of considering this proposal, did you consider the possibility of not taking the license for failure to pay a fine? Because you could have both a fine given and a surcharge given, and either one of them would suspend your license for failure to pay. Have you ever thought about not suspending the license?
Mr. Chair, members, the challenge with that, Representative Hillstrom, is without having that penalty, you wouldn't get compliance. What the DDP program has established in the jurisdictions that's being used is you're having people that come in, they take the traffic safety class, they become compliant, they prove that they're insured, they prove that they're eligible to get their license back, and they set up sometimes as long as an 18-month payment plan, and they pay every month towards their fines, fees, and the surcharge. And then if you don't pay, then you're no longer compliant with the DDP program, and your license is again removed because you're no longer compliant with the diversion program. Without that hook there, I don't know how you would get compliance.
It's kind of like the carrot and the stick. It's the same way in child custody. You take away the father's license because he's not paying the child support, and then he can't get to work. So it's always a balance there. So, Representative Frankie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I represent Zerwas, or maybe many of the many attorneys in this room. I was wondering if any thought was given to, now, correct me if I'm wrong, somebody, but if a fine is imposed, sometimes they allow the ability to work off in community service hours versus a fine. So has any thought been given to the fact of, instead of forgiving the surcharge, allowing them to work that off as instead of just a complete forgiveness?
I think there's a bill to do this.
Your name and title again and begin.
Mary Ellen Hang, Criminal Deputy. In my experience, Representative, because it is not waivable, it must be imposed, at least in our county, that has been interpreted by our chief judge that you cannot even allow a community service option, or we have sentenced the service option, because by making it a shall impose, it's a clear directive that it must be the financial penalty. I agree with you. I think the other option that we haven't brought up, which I'm glad you did, is by making it waivable, I think does open the door to that where, which for me as a prosecutor, I like. If you can't afford it, but you can do 4 hours of community service somewhere to be held accountable and have some consequence for your behavior, I fully support that. And I think that would be an option under the bill that we've proposed. But if it stays a mandatory imposition, I think most judges are going to continue on that that path of saying the only thing we can do is impose a financial burden and there's no other options.
Thank you.
Representative Hilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this year we already heard a proposal to allow people to work it off, even if it stayed a mandatory. Not that I'm saying that it should, but I definitely think that that would be a piece that we should consider.
Okay. Any other members? Do we have another testifier?
Yeah, we have one more testifier, Mr. Chair.
And this would be Amy Tudor, is that right?
Yes.
And you are Family Advocate Housing Case Manager for Three Rivers Community Action Agency?
That's correct.
Okay,
I'm
go ahead,
Mr.
Ma'am.
Chair and committee members. As you just said, my name is Amy Tudor. I'm a social worker at Three Rivers Community Action Agency in Faribault, where I work as a housing case manager and family advocate for low-income families. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to come and talk with you today. The story that Jeanette just gave you about her client is something I see almost every single day. I work with many single parents who are living below the poverty line. They work low-wage jobs. They're trying to take care of their children and doing those day-to-day tasks that requires getting to and from work, going to the grocery store, getting their kids to and from school activities, doctor's appointments, all those kinds of things. If they're lucky, all of these places are within just a few miles of their home, but more than likely they're not. So if they have a car and a valid driver's license, this is doable. And if they don't, their life just became that much more difficult. The families that I work with are very similar to you and I. The only difference is that they are living below the poverty line and trying to get by on an extremely low budget with minimal supports. And just like you and I, sometimes they get pulled over for a minor traffic violation, such as a broken taillight. But with limited income, they wind up with a ticket that they cannot afford to pay. They're faced with the difficult choice, to pay for their rent and other basic needs, or to pay their ticket. And like many good parents, they're going to choose to keep a roof over their kids' heads and food on the table and be at risk for having their license suspended for these unpaid tickets. And to be clear, this is not a choice that they are comfortable with, and this is not a choice that they make easily. But at the end of the month, after rent and groceries and utilities are paid, there is simply not enough money left in their budget to cover a $40 traffic ticket along with a $75 surcharge. So over time, these accrued fines and fees result in a debt load that they simply cannot climb out of. And it's not because of DUIs or for car accidents, but it's because they were driving out of necessity with suspended or revoked licenses as a result of unpaid fines and fees just to keep up with their daily responsibilities. For those living below the poverty line, this is an amount that they cannot imagine ever having in hand at one time. They're in a difficult position because they want to stay in compliance with the laws, but they're also living in a reality that means they cannot get unburied from this debt. Fortunately, I work in a county that offers the driver diversion program, and I currently have two clients that are enrolled. When my clients discovered that they could have their license reinstated immediately while paying off their fines and fees, they jumped at the chance to participate. After getting approved for the program and completing the required class, I had a client who came back to my office with a huge smile on her face and talked about what a huge load off of her shoulders this was. She's a single mother, and after months of taking the bus to the grocery store, lining up rides to and from work, relying on her neighbors to get her places, and paying really high cab fares to get to and from her monthly doctor's appointments, she's now driving, and she is paying off her debt. So while this program has proven to be effective for some of my clients, there are a few things that could make it even better. First of all, it's only the pilot, so payment plans are limited to those 18 months. This means that in order to pay off an accrued debt in that limited time frame, a person who owes, say, $3,500 in accrued fines and fees has to pay $195 a month to get that amount paid off in full over the 18 months. If the program were made permanent, then people would be allowed more time to pay off their accrued debt, and those monthly fees payments could be lowered to be more manageable. Secondly, my clients are fortunate to be living in a county that offers the driver diversion program, it is time that this program is spread throughout all of Minnesota to help all low-income families. So when I told my clients that I was coming here to talk to you today, the first thing that they asked me to do was to thank you and tell you how grateful that they are for the driver diversion program. And on behalf of all of my clients, I'm asking you to vote yes on this bill. Your vote can enable low-income families throughout all of Minnesota to be more responsible, more successful, and self-sufficient.
I had a question of Mr. Walsh. We're going to find out. The question was, when they're figuring out the fiscal note, trying to ascertain whether it was surcharges in total, like all the charges, or if they broke it down. I was trying to find out exactly how many a DAS or DAR, driving after suspension or driving after revocation, citations or were in Hennepin County. It looks like the fiscal note took it in the totality of anything that a surcharge is charged on. And the reason I was thinking about this is because we might not want the surcharges diminished on more serious violations, or it shouldn't be, whereas a driving after suspension, driving after revocation without an accident involved wouldn't be that serious. So we'll try to find out some more specific information on that. But Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If you're getting additional data, it would be great if we could get some data about what kinds of tickets are actually going to driver's license suspensions for failure to pay. And amounts so that we get a general sense on this. And there may be, for example, I may not be fond of a DWI waiver. I may not be fond of some other waivers, but for the most part, there may be many of these pieces that I would be just fine with, but it's really good for us to know, if we can, Mr. Chair, which ones result in license revocations and which ones are everything, the entire fine has been waived and it just is the criminal traffic surcharge. But I do have one last question for the city who is proposing this, if I might, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead, Representative Holt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the question is whether or not the state will waive the criminal traffic surcharge. But in many instances when there's multiple charges, the state only imposes one criminal traffic surcharge. My question is, how much of the city's portion of this is the city waiving in comparison to what you're planning to waive from the state? Because I would want to make certain that if you're asking us to waive our portion, that the city is actually putting up their portion as well.
Representative Hillstrom, Mary Ellen Hing. In my experience, it, at least for Minneapolis, it's exactly opposite. If you come to any of our courthouses, you will see consistently the Hennepin County judges suspending and waiving the fines that are that, and the way the just for some information, when a fine is imposed, whatever that dollar amount is, Minneapolis gets 80% of that dollar amount. That goes back into the city's general fund. 20% goes to the state. The surcharge, 100% goes to the state. So the $75, none of that money goes to any municipality. It goes entirely to the state. And part of the reason that I support this is because I stand in the courtroom every day and I watch judges suspend the fine so that the municipality gets $0, but then the state is forcing them to collect money for the state. It's exactly the opposite of what you're stating is occurring in Minneapolis. In other suburbs and that, it's differently. In Edina, fines are routinely imposed, and they're imposed in the hundreds of dollars because they have a population that can afford to pay more fines in Minneapolis. But if you come to our courtrooms, you will hardly see anybody actually. They'll impose the fine, but they'll stay it. They'll suspend it due to indigency, which means that we're not collecting any money. And so that is just the reality. In our courtroom, it obviously differs state to state, and I'm sure it's different. But there is definitely some inequity, but I think from my jurisdiction, it's the opposite. We're the ones that are not collecting any revenue off of the criminal justice system while the state is.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gilstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As we're getting fiscal numbers as well, if we could get some information about that, because we may want to put some proportionality requirements if pieces are going to be waived, that maybe it has to be equally divided between the entities or something in the event we're going to see this back here.
But and then keep in mind that the money goes to the state. It's kind of a misnomer. A lot of that money comes back to the entire judicial system, plus the victims, the court, public defenders, the veterans courts, the mentally ill courts, and victim rights. It goes to the state, but a lot of it comes back. So, and that's what we're trying to deal with here, because not robbing Peter to pay Paul, but just certain parts of it look maybe counterproductive. So, but we like the bill in its totality, like I said. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So one question for Representative Zawas, maybe for the testifier. If I'm understanding this right, the driver diversion program part of the bill and the surcharge part of the bill really are separate. So if there is a concern with the cost of the surcharge, the driver diversion program part, making that permanent, et cetera, can happen regardless. I'm kind of seeing the testifier nodding.
Representative Zawas.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members, I think I look at the $75 unwaivable as sometimes a really disproportionately impacts people in poverty. I think when you tell people you can't get your license back until you pay this, I think in some instances what we're doing as a state is criminalizing poverty, and I'm not comfortable with that. The driver diversion program exists today in a pilot project version. The bill we have before you, that the portions that deal with the driver diversion program deal with making it permanent, because right now it sunsets at the end of the year, and it expands it statewide. That can happen without the waivability of the surcharge.
And Mr. Chair and Representative Wilson, I don't want my question to be misunderstood, because I'm fully supportive of the waiver of the surcharge portion of it. I completely agree with you, and I feel like I see this in cases all the time of people having this situation where they get trapped deeper and deeper. And I mean, all the points that have been made, totally agree. I do want to. I know this is a dangerous game to dive into a fiscal note, but I just want to ask about this. Maybe for Mr. Walls, and then to pursue along some of the other. We're going to do some other follow up when I'm looking at this, it looks like the way the fiscal note is put together is to take the total number, total amount of surcharges that are collected. This is on page 9 of the fiscal note under the expenditure and our revenue formula. Taking the total amount collected, figuring that 7% of the cases have public defenders, and then taking, figuring that we're going to lose 7% of the amount collected. But by my calculations, we already are collecting only half of the money that we could be in surcharges. And I'm getting that point by the, there's about $34, $35 million being collected total, but those surcharges are being imposed in 876,000 cases in 2016. You divide that out, you get $38 per case. We should be collecting 75. I think it is logical to assume that most of what we're losing is, as Ms. Berner referenced, that people who can't pay. I mean, we're really talking about people in deep poverty. They can't pay $75. They can't pay $5. And so they're not paying it anyway. So, and again, I know this is a dangerous game, but I would wonder if there's anything, if the department could simply be asked about that pushback just slightly to find out, is there any further granularity we can get on what kind of surcharges are actually being paid in public defender cases, because that's what we're talking about. And just taking 7% of the total amount collected is probably not accurate, because the PD clients are people who are probably not paying right now, so really wouldn't lose much money. And, of course, overall, we'd gain because people can get to their jobs, they can pay taxes, they cannot rely on government handouts because they have jobs, because right now they're having to choose between going to a job and driving illegally or staying home and respecting the law in that way, but then not being able to have money for their family and to pay taxes. So I guess I'm not sure if there's much we can do about that, but if we can, I'd certainly ask for that. I'm very strongly supportive and really appreciate your work and those of the testifiers as well. Thanks.
Chair Cornish.
Representative
Pinto wins the prize today, and I think he's spot on. You can't lose out on what we're not collecting. And that's what we're facing right now. Just in the driver diversion program, just in the pilot version of it, we've brought in $6.6 million since 2010. It's about $1.3 million a year. And make no mistake, members, that's $1.3 million a year in fines and fees that otherwise would not be collected. If there wasn't a payment plan allowing these people to get to work, what would they be trying to do? They'd be trying to go under the radar, they'd be driving unlicensed or uninsured, and they wouldn't be paying on their fines and fees. This bill will allow the opportunity statewide to get people to come out from the shadows, to be legal, to be insured, which is better for all of us, to have insured drivers on the road, and it would allow them to have a way out, a light at the end of the tunnel. And I said it once before, but I completely believe it, Representative Pinto. Without a prospect of allowing people to dig out from this, what we're doing for people that get a traffic violation and then a driving after suspension, we stack this up on them. It doesn't take long. Then you have a driver reinstatement fee of several hundred dollars. It doesn't take long before you're $1,000 in the hole, before you'll ever get a chance to get your license back. What the heck are you going to do? You can't get to work. You can't drive your kids to daycare. You can't go out to look for a job. You are absolutely held captive by this process. And why? Because you're poor. That's wrong. It's fundamentally wrong, and we can improve that by having this process go statewide. Just really briefly, Mr. Chair, I want to address Representative Considine's question for the DDP program for individuals that have had a DWI. You need to fulfill your entire court-ordered driver suspension first, before you could ever qualify for the program, and then you would qualify for the program only in conjunction with Interlock. And so this doesn't in any way, by allowing this to be eligible for DWI offenses, this doesn't in any way lessen or mitigate the penalty, the criminal penalty and the wait period to get your driver's license back. All this says is once you've met all of your criminal penalty obligations, but now you have a $1,500 or $2,000 fine fee and license reinstatement barrier between you and your driver's license, you can get your license back if you prove that you're insured, prove that you have Interlock, you take the traffic safety class, you sign up for the payment plan, and you stay compliant. So this in no way lowers or reduces the criminal fines, fees, or impact of a DWI infraction. I just want to make that crystal clear to Representative Considine.
The chair is busy at the moment, so I'll just address it back to you. Thank you for clarifying it. I am much more comfortable with this idea now.
Thank you, Representative Considine.
The question I was asking Mr. Walls is trying to find out when these the driver diversion program, the fees collected, is that where do they write that check out to, the companies that collect it? What fund does that go? Is it general fund of the state? Do you know where that check is directed to?
Mr. Chair, since 2010, $6.6 million has been collected. 25% of that goes to the state through the surcharge, and 20 to 50% of the remaining fine revenue collected goes to the state. It's varied based on the location of the traffic infraction and the difference in the statutory formulas for where that traffic ticket is paid back.
Okay. Any questions from members? Any more testifiers? Public testimony. Okay, seeing none, Representative Zerwa, thank you for your bill, and you can renew your motion to lay it over if you'd like.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will renew my motion.
Okay, Representative Zerwa renews his motion. House File 1670 laid over for possible inclusion as amended. All in favor? Oh, no, we don't have to vote on that. Sorry about that. And meeting adjourned.